We are on the subject of poverty this morning. What causes poverty and what is the cure for poverty? More important. From the squatter camps to the rundown ghettos to the refugee camps, Christians are struggling to respond to suffering with practical love. The difference of productivity and income between the West and the Third World has been getting more and more acute. In the 19th century, it said that the Western World was twice as productive as the Third World, but today it's more like 70 to more like 100 to 1. It's not a matter of riches as much as productivity. If you don't farm enough, if you don't produce enough, you will suffer. The question is productivity. The escalating disparity between the productive and the unproductive nations, along with the impact of natural and man-made disasters, and the man-made disaster much, much, much worse than the natural disasters, this has greatly increased the flow of refugees and illegal aliens into Western nations. People are pouring as never before in the history of the world by the millions and the tens of millions from third world nations under dictatorships where there's no freedom, from socialist nations into countries where there's more productivity and where there's no starvation. It is also greatly aggravating the spread of diseases, environmental degradation, escalation of crime, possibilities of conflict. Just take Cape Town. Cape Town's a very civilized part of the world, but you can now get hepatitis in Cape Town, as my wife discovered. I would have thought I'd be the one who'd get hepatitis, but my wife got it. How do you get hepatitis in Cape Town? Because of first-stage urbanization refugees who've come from countries where they do have it, who've been pouring into our city, who don't have the same hygiene. We used to have forests going as far as the eye can see. When you traveled from Cape Town through to the airport, through to Somerset West, all the way up to Krabbo, you'd pass through forest on both sides. I remember that. Since 1994, millions of trees in the Western Cape have been chopped down. Some of them for firewood, but most of them because the government thinks trees take water away, even though trees actually produce rain. But we don't have some very intelligent people up there. One of the main responses of industrial nations has been to supply generous amounts of foreign aid to poorer nations. This does not help. The vast amounts of relief aid have actually encouraged the lack of productivity and have compounded the problem. Foreign aid has been accused of denying poorer nations the chance to develop their economies to viability. Because most aid doesn't encourage self-sufficiency and growth. It's one thing to teach a person to fish. It's one thing to teach a person how to build and how to plant bread. It's another thing to just provide them with the food and thereby encourage them not to even be planting or fishing. The dumping of food aid surplus has damaged local agriculture in the long term. It's hard for farmers to sell what's been given away. Now, I've seen that. I remember taking vast amounts of food to the Mozambican refugees in Gazankulu and seeing the food distributed. But as we stayed there, unlike most bleeding heart liberal do-gooders who just came, handed over the food, went back to Johannesburg, we stayed and we ministered. We were told by the local people, you see, most of the people coming to receive the aid aren't even Mozambicans. Many of the Shangaan people in the area thought, why should Shangaans from across the border in Mozambique get free food? Why must we work and sweat in the heat of the day and have to plow and harvest when they're getting free food? So they stopped plowing their fields and they got in the line as well. And then people in the shops who were trying to sell blankets and clothes and agricultural products couldn't do so because we were giving it away free. How could they sell now what we're giving away free? And so we saw that well-intentioned missionaries and churches were actually undermining the entrepreneurs, the farmers, and the hard-working people in the communities. In fact, what was happening is an abundance of bread and idleness was leading to more crime and social vices and a breakdown of family structures as well. While we must certainly love our neighbor, especially the deserving poor, we need to be wise and discerning so as to encourage responsibility and rehabilitation. The goal of aid is to help the person get on his own feet as soon as possible, not to make him dependent forever. Now, the abuse of relief aid. This is some of the poor in South Africa given food, and you can see how much has just been abandoned, uneaten. The fruit, whole foods, whole juices just left lying on the ground. This is food aid, yes. I am sorry to tell you, this is Cape Town. This is Khayelitsha. Last year, why would people abandon food? Well, well-intentioned people wanted to give poor people good food, and this is good food. But they despise the fruit, they despise the juice, they despise the most, I mean, most of the food's just been thrown, not even thrown in the bins. You see, there are bins. So, instead of actually helping people need, the people now scorn the very aid they've been given. I've seen relief aid abused. When I was a soldier, we captured this picture. This is a picture of Russian commissars training communist terrorists in Angola, and you can see the Marx brothers, Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, Vladimir Lenin, up on the wall. And there you can see a Russian P-76 amphibious tank outside the window, and South African troops, Fidel Castro and Leonid Brezhnev's pics, with SWAPO terrorist posters on the wall. This was a terrorist training camp. Weapons from the Soviet Union. Definitely Soviet manufactured weapons, multiple grenade launchers, Soviet script, Chinese script. But what else do you find in these terrorist camps? Gift of the Christian Peace Movement for the Zimbabwe African National Union. This was ZANU terrorist materials received in Chamoyo. This is the base that my brother raided when he was in Rhodesian Army. And there they had relief aid helping terrorist groups. So the weapons came from the communist Soviet Union and Red China. But the food came from Western Christian peace movements. That's abuse of relief aid, I think you'll agree. Since 1954, the United States of America have shipped millions of tons of food aid to the Indian government, not to private businesses or private agencies in India, but to Indian governments. Rats have consumed more than half of this food at the docks and storage facilities before it could be distributed to the people. Because of Hinduism's belief in reincarnation, rats and sacred cows may not be killed for food. They worship their hamburgers. It would take a train 3,000 miles, that's about almost 4,500 kilometers long, to haul a grain eaten by Indian rats in a single year. Take a train from Cape Town up to Uganda, that long, filled with grain, that's how much grain is eaten in a single year by rats in India. The sacred cows in India eat enough food to feed most of Asia. The Hindu temples contain vast fortunes of gold, rubies, sapphires, and other precious stones in their statues, which are worshipped as idols. They worship their wealth, and they worship their food. No wonder the people are starving in parts of India. It's actually Hinduism's reincarnation beliefs. It's its sacred cows, its protected rats, its idols made of gold and jewels, wasted resources and superstition that have caused the poverty and starvation in some parts of India. Ethiopia is another classic example of a man-made famine in the 1980s. 1974, the communists took over Ethiopia, murdered the last royal family, Haile Selassie, a reign that had lasted over 3,000 years, wiped out this monarchy and imposed communism. Socialism, confiscation, nationalization, abolishing incentive, punishing of productivity, subsidizing of irresponsibility, caused starvation in what used to be the breadbasket of Africa. If you found a pre-1974 encyclopedia, it would tell you how Ethiopia had the potential to feed all of Africa if they fully utilized the agricultural potential. They could have fed everyone in Africa just from Ethiopia. And yet Ethiopia went from being a food exporter to being a country that was totally dependent on foreign aid. If you were brought up in the 1980s, you would have been raising money in your schools for starving in Ethiopia. Just like in 1969, 1970, we were raising money for Biafra in Nigeria. Again, a man-made famine because the Muslim government was burning the crops and starving out the Christians in the south of Nigeria at that time. But in the 1980s, it was Ethiopia, communist Ethiopia. The Red Terror under Mengistu, who's today living under Mugabe's protection in Zimbabwe, had mass executions, forced removals of millions of people. The biggest forced removals Africa has ever seen was in Ethiopia, when Addis Ababa was the headquarters of the organization African Unity. They were forced removing millions of people into the desert, where they were totally dependent on relief aid, where they couldn't even grow anything, and then letting them die of starvation because they didn't listen to the commissar. And they were destroying crops, burning down crops and aggravating the famine. The corruption and abuse of relief aid in Ethiopia was the ultimate scandal. I was in Germany at Frankfurt for Kirchentag in 1987 on a Christian Action tour, and I happened to sit next to the Mercedes-Benz representative for Africa. And I was most fascinated. He had just come back from Ethiopia, and I wanted to know why. He said, oh, they wanted us to replace the Mercedes-Benz trucks, which they said were defective. So I said, well, what happened? He said, well, I told them I'd publicize what they're doing if they persisted in this nonsense. And I said, well, what are they doing? He said, they're using the trucks to ferry Cuban and Soviet tanks around. And of course, our trucks were designed for ferrying of relief aid, not tanks, not 60-ton tanks. So no wonder these trucks are being wrecked on those disgustingly bad roads with no end of potholes. I said, what are the trucks doing there? Oh, he said, the government of Ethiopia will not allow relief agencies like World Vision to give any aid to the country free. They've got to pay 100% import tax on the free relief aid. So you want to give $1 million of grain to the Ethiopian people who are starving because of communist policies. The communist government says you've got to give us $1 million import duty to be able to feed our people, whose crops we've been burning down, of course. And relief agencies like World Vision were raising enough money that they could pay 100% import tax to take free food in to distribute freely to the people in Ethiopia. But then they also had to provide brand new Mercedes-Benz trucks, a certain amount per every so many thousand tons for distribution. And they had to pay 100% import tax on the trucks, and the trucks had to be signed over to the Ethiopian government's ownership. All this while the government of Ethiopia, the communist government, spent $70 million on the anniversary of the revolution in 1984, half of which went to vodka, alcohol, for them to celebrate the revolution. They couldn't feed their own people, but they could charge 100% import tax on Christian relief agencies who are rocking against the famine, Band-Aid and all the rest, who are trying to feed their people who are starving because of socialism. Much of the relief aid and food that arrived actually was used for the tens of thousands of Cuban, Soviet and East German military who were involved in causing the famine and burning down the crops and the scorched earth. Much of the food aid that Western nations sent into Ethiopia were actually immediately exported in payment for weapons to the Soviet Union. Food would come to the dockside and immediately be reloaded on Soviet ships shipped out. This was Ethiopia in the 1980s. If you wanted to know how to run a famine, this is it. You can imagine, if you're a communist dictator of one of these banana republics and you see how things are working, you call in your Minister of Agriculture and you say, make sure we have lots of famine. Famine's a gold mine. The more famine, the more aid we can get. The more taxes, the more import duty, the more Mercedes-Benz trucks to ferry Cuban tanks around that can burn down the crops and smash the villages. This is just outstanding. And they will even pay import tax on the free aid and on the trucks that they're giving to us, to the government. The idiocy of Western nations and churches and mission groups is beyond comprehension. Mozambique was my first mission field. In the 1980s, Mozambique was another classic example of a man-made famine in a country which used to export food. Mozambique was a green country, a country that is tropical. And yet, in a place where bananas were hanging on almost every second tree, there was famine. After the communist revolution of 1975, a socialist economy was forced upon the people. All farms were confiscated. All factories were nationalized. Hundreds of thousands of people were incarcerated in concentration camps. This is where the communist officials from the Soviet Union were housed. This is pre-liberation. This is what Beira looked like at the beachfront under the Portuguese. This is the days of exploitation. And this is how the same beachfront looked after they were liberated. So, before socialism, after socialism. Change you can't believe in. This is the Grand Hotel in Beira before socialism. This is the Grand Hotel after socialism. Socialism can really improve a country, don't you agree? Over 75,000 people were accused of being black marketeers, reactionaries, counter-revolutionaries, and were publicly executed. 75,000 public executions in Mozambique under Samora Machel. Food was exported to the Soviet bloc in exchange for weapons. I saw it. I remember when the Elgin farmers in Cape Town, which is where we have our January camps, one of the biggest apple-producing regions anywhere, and they sent 5 million apples to Mozambique, one for every child in Mozambique. I mean, that's a very nice gesture. But none of those apples reached the children of Mozambique. They were immediately loaded onto Soviet ships and shipped off to Russia to pay for weapons. That's just one that I happened to have been at the dockside when that happened. But there's so many examples like that. Here you can see a Soviet ship that came into the harbor, offloaded tanks, trucks, helicopter gunships, rocket launchers, and it went out also low in the water, heavy, fully laden. What did this poor, starving, bankrupt country have to export? Food. They were exporting food, while a million people died of starvation behind the barbed wire. There was a scorched earth policy launched to starve out the resistance to the Frelimo government by burning down crops and villages. When I was captured by Russian soldiers and put into MI-8 HIP helicopters back in 1989, and I was flown to prison and interrogations, we flew over country burning from far north of Tet all the way down to Maputo. I saw burning villages, burning crops, burning fields as far as we were flying everywhere. At no point was I not seeing burning somewhere in the distance as we flew from one side of the country to the other. I was flying over a country aflame. I turned to the Russian pilot and I said, "What's happening?" He said, "We're burning out the crops to starve out the resistance." I said, "Who's doing this?" He said, "We are. We're draining the sea to catch the fish." Scorched earth. And that was the very time that the West was sacrificing to send aid to help the starving in Mozambique. I took these pictures, burned out villages, burned out churches. Developing world. They speak about this being the developing world. In fact, the only thing developing was rust and weeds. Thousands of kilometers of roads and railways were just being recovered by the bush and the jungle. And about the only signs of civilization in many places was the wreckage of war. Missionaries had to design a new kind of bicycle, actually a tricycle, where people who'd lost their legs to landmines could now pedal with their hands. How does a poor person with feet get around? So we had to literally have missions designing tricycles for people without legs. 8,000 churches destroyed or confiscated. Bureaucratic wastage and corruption became a growth industry. Economic poverty and social chaos resulted. But in Mozambique, it wasn't only Marxism that caused the starvation. It was animism as well. The widespread practice of ancestral worship led many poor families to sacrifice their last goat or chicken to appease the ancestral spirits. Instead of feeding their kids, they were giving this to the witch doctor as a sacrifice. And that's not going to help anyone. If you think we're just talking about Africa and India, let's talk about Europe. In Albania and Romania, I have come across gypsies. Now, gypsies are these migrants who just wander around. They tell fortunes. They're into all kinds of clairvoyant stuff. In Albania and Romania, I've come across gypsies deliberately starving their babies and laying out the malnourished infants on the sidewalks where the hat necks them to beg for money. I remember on my first trip to Albania, reaching in my pocket to put some money into a hat, and the Christians who were with me grabbed my arm and said, "Don't do it! They starve their babies to get this money, and they're going to use this money not for the baby. They're going to use it for alcohol and drugs. You can't support this." And Bill Bathman says in India, he came across people who actually maimed or mutilated their children to make them look more pitiful and therefore more effective at street begging. I don't know how a parent can do a thing like that, but that is what happens in some of these dark and demonic oppressed countries. In South Africa, having spent many months on the streets of Hillbrow and Durban doing street evangelism, I've seen professional beggars at work. I've seen cripples, even within a block of our mission at Campground Road, letting down their strapped legs, stretching, after they've been hopping along in their crutches with their, you know, looking like they've got a stump of a leg, and seeing them, you know, by the side of the road there, letting down their leg and trying to get a massage, a bit more blood circulation into this. I've seen the blind lifting up their dog glass to count the money in the hat. Some street children have told how they could make 200 rand a day from begging, and there's many ministries that try to help these people who say, those Christians who help spontaneously hand over some coins to strangers, beg on streets, are actually doing more harm than good. They say, giving to beggars on the streets normally goes to subsidizing drunkenness, smoking, drugs, prostitution, gambling. Some of the beggars are child prostitutes and thieves, using begging as a cover-up, looking for opportunities, opportunistic criminals. And the problem is that when we spontaneously try to give money, as opposed to food, to street beggars, what we are actually doing is we are enabling them to stay on the streets longer instead of going to the ministries that could help them, like the Ark, Cape Town City Mission, Dops Mission. There's many good groups, Salvation Army and others, who will give them a bed, will give them food, will give them an opportunity to get work. But they've always got some rules. When I was up in Hillbrow, I found there were 16 ministries that would give bed, food, bath, shower, and work opportunities to anyone who needed. And then most of them, they said, always had empty beds at night. Why? Many people prefer to be on the streets. Because of the rules. What rules? Well, some of these ministries had rules like you can't bring drink onto the premises, or you can't be drunk on the premises. Some said you could be drunk on the premises, but you couldn't bring drink on the premises. All of them, you had to attend a church service at least once a week, some once a day. Some of them had other sort of rules and requirements, but none of these people on the streets wanted that, and they said they could make so much money on the streets, they didn't want to come and be part of a discipleship ministry that could teach them skills to get out of this lifestyle. Then there's the religious con men who know the terminology and can deceive and manipulate the unsuspecting into handing over large quantities of cash for spurious causes. Now, for example, there's one time I'd just come out of the army. I was in Durban. I was preparing, going around, organizing things, literature ministries and so on for our first mission to Mozambique to launch Frontline Fellowship. And an Indian man passed me in the streets of Durban. I was handing out gospel tracts, just walking down West Street. And this person turned to me and said, "Are you a Christian?" It's kind of obvious. I was handing out gospel tracts. He said, "Yes." He said, "Oh, praise the Lord. What denomination are you?" So I said, "Baptist." He said, "Oh, praise God. I'm a Baptist. I was converted through Rex Mathew." I said, "Rick, I was converted through Rex Mathew too." I mean, Rex Mathew was the most famous Baptist at that time. I'm not picking all this up yet. And he said, "Oh, do you know Trevor Swart?" "Well, yes, he's the General Secretary of the Baptist Union. Actually, I'm a member of the Baptist Mission Society." "Oh, he says, I work for the Baptist Mission Society. I've just been a friend to Trevor Swart. I've been robbed, and I need to get on a train now. I need to borrow 45 rand to get the train fare up to Joburg. 1981, I traveled from Cape Town to Joburg, and my petrol was 35 rand. Cape Town to Johannesburg. So 45 rand is a lot of money in that time, 1981. So he needs 45 rand. Well, I didn't have 45 rand. So I went along to a friend of mine, and he didn't have it either. So he sent me to his mother, and his mother didn't have it either, but she borrowed from someone else at work, gave me the 45 rand, and gave this Indian. He's going to put it in bank account, this and the other. Trevor Swart, the General Secretary of the Baptist Union, promised this and the other, took down names and details, never heard from him again. Well, next thing, When I contacted Baptist Missions Barton, I never heard this guy before. But then I saw in Assemblies of God magazine that I was receiving, warning about Indian con man who pretends to be Assemblies of God and he's conning many people and he knows all names and so on. Next thing I saw the Apostolic Faith Mission warning about an Indian con man who's pretending to be Apostolic Faith Mission evangelist. Later I saw the Baptist Today magazine had a warning about this Indian con man who pretends to be a Baptist. This man knew every bit of terminology and who's who in each of these denominations. And he would just, he'd look for people and he would, you know, what, the moment he's marked you and he's worked out what you are, he's that. And everything follows. We had someone write to us from India. And on his magazine, on his letterhead, he actually had the Frontline Fellowship badge. And he is called Frontline Fellowship India. He wrote to us asking for support. And I said, you know, we don't work in Asia, this, that, and the other. We're hard-pressed to do the work we're doing in Africa. We don't have enough people, enough resources. We never take up an offering. We're a faith mission, etc. And so I recommended a group I knew in Switzerland, Christian Solidarity International. But then just to warn them, I wrote to them and said, listen, there's someone who's writing to you from India. He's got a Frontline Fellowship India letterhead. They're nowhere related to us. He must have just chosen us, but I've just said we don't work in Asia. Referred him to you. Got a letter back from a friend in Zurich. Funny you should mention it. The same person, same name. He sent me a letterhead with our logo, Christian Solidarity International India. There's no end. We get people writing to us saying, I've translated your book, Putting Feature Faith, into Hindi. And could you help us with the money to get this printed? So please send us a copy of it. We know some people at Jivanadi Mission who also speak Hindi and can help us in proofreading it. Never heard from them again. You know, there are con men out there. There are thousands who have no problem stealing from and lying to Christians because they know Christians are gullible, Christians are generous, Christians want to help, and therefore we're an excellent target for these con artists. Masses and masses and masses of them. Multiplied millions of rands are squandered by guilt-manipulated, gullible Christians giving to beggars at traffic lights, at the front door and on the streets. At the same time, there are excellent ministries like the Salvation Army, the Doctors Mission, the ARC, Cape Town City Mission, and many others who are struggling for lack of support. If Christians would take that money that they've given to these con artists, criminals, drug addicts, alcoholics, and thieves that they are supporting, and they took that money and gave it to groups like the ARC, imagine what they could do to actually reach these people with the gospel and to give them bread and food and clothes and a warm shower and to give them job opportunities and to disciple them and give them counsel because they know the people. But instead, the church spends more money on giving to the beggars than giving to the ministries that would actually really help them and have results. So you can see there's some problem here. Now, I'm not saying we don't help people in need. Jesus can come in disguise. Whatever you did unto one of the least of these, you did unto me. I travel around with packets of peanuts and raisins, some tins of food, and so on my vehicle, and I give those to people who beg. I'll give food, but I'm not going to give money. So I'm not saying we don't do anything, but I'm saying when you give money, it's easy to convert them to cigarettes and drink. There's a desperate need for good stewardship of our limited resources. Hey, if we had unlimited resources, that's one thing, but we don't. It would be more responsible to channel our compassion to supporting Christian ministries who've proven their effectiveness in reaching out in love to help the poor. Those with track record. So biblical charity should not subsidize sin. Are you subsidizing sin by helping people to afford their next gambling spree? You notice that the government, in their love for the poor, has put even lotto machines and one-armed bandits and all that into the townships amongst the poorest of people. The poorest people gamble the most. The people who can afford to lose the money the least are the ones who actually put the most money into gambling. But biblical charity should encourage responsibility, not irresponsibility. So, before we get down to some practical strategies to care for the poor and to eradicate poverty, we need to define poverty. and consider what causes poverty. A definition of poverty would be an insufficiency of the material necessities for life. Now let me tell you, there's a bunch of people in America who think they're poor. And they live on food stamps. And they all have TV, cell phones, vehicles, air conditioning, vast amounts of all sorts of things. They're not poor by any definition whatsoever. And yet they've got a chip on their shoulder. I know about poor people. This is in Kotobi in Sudan. And this is the only water pump for 16,000 people. They all have to come to this one water pump to get the water. And they count themselves lucky. There's many people who don't have a water pump available for them. This is good, clean drinking water. This is excellent. But, of course, we all have hot and cold water running in our rooms. Persons who do not have or are unable to obtain the means for sustaining life, if they to survive, they are dependent upon the resources of other people. That's how you could describe the poor. Most important question is, what causes poverty? There are four broad categories under which all causes of poverty could be grouped. Number one, personal sacrifice. Some people are poor because they choose to be poor because they want to be self-sacrificing. For example, you could take the monks and the nuns, you could take many missionaries who could be living in better conditions, but who choose sacrificially to live a poor life. Then you get slothfulness, laziness. Many people are poor because they're lazy. Many are poor because of calamity, earthquakes, floods, tsunamis, and so on. And then there are those who are poor because of exploitation. Okay, let's consider self-imposed poverty. The lazy and the indolent, the slothful, inevitably suffer the consequences of their sin. There are people who are too lazy to even provide their own food. The Bible speaks of those who are too lazy to even lift up the food from the plate into their mouth. He who is slothful in his work as a brother to him is a great destroyer. How long will you slumber, sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. So shall your poverty come on you like a robber. Because of laziness, the building decays. Through idleness of hands, the house leaks. I was ministering up in Kabwe, which used to be Broken Hill in Zambia, and I was taken to the house that used to belong to the man who was my pastor at that time, 40 years before, when he was a child and living in Broken Hill, when it was Northern Rhodesia. So I was taken through there and I was shown, this is where your pastor used to stay when he was an 8-year-old child, and so on. Seeing the house, and the person said, oh, the roof's leaking here and this needs fixing and that needs fixing. I said, wait a minute, this is your house. It's not my house. It's not even my pastor's house. He left it over 40 years ago. It's your house. If the building is leaking today, it's because you're lazy. Through laziness of hands, the roof leaks. That mentality of some people. The Americans are awfully generous. And it's Mexico's dubious honor to be the near neighbor of America. And every summer, there are Americans who flood across the border, youth groups, Bible study, Bible groups, and so on. And they go and they build churches or repair churches or build homes for the Mexicans. Now, the Mexicans are bone idle, obviously, or they would build their own. There's nothing lacking in Mexico where they don't have enough labor. They've got labor. Now, I can understand an American coming and showing them how to build better, or working alongside them and teaching them some new skills, or maybe bring some new materials and helping them. But what normally happens is you get this youth group or this men's group that come in, and within a week or two they've built this church. Painted, fixed, everything. Hand the keys over to the church. I heard from one church in America, they built this church in Mexico, and for 2 years they heard nothing. There wasn't a thank you letter, there wasn't a word, a report from the church in Mexico. Then one day they got a letter from the elders of this church in Mexico. Your roof is leaking, come fix it. Your roof is leaking. These lazy Mexicans should have been flogged. Where's their gratitude? But they didn't see it as their church. They didn't put any sweat or effort into it. It's the gringo church. The gringos built it. The gringos must fix it. Their church's roof is leaking. It is a disgrace to be lazy, the Bible says. Lazy people always find excuses not to work. The Bible's got some creative examples. The lazy man tosses in his bed. He gets no further than the doors swing on its hinges. He says, if I go outside, a lion might get me. We've got all kinds of stories. Those people who love sleep will grow poor. It is no accident that the most productive, hardworking place on earth are the wealthiest. It's no accident that the animistic, lazy, slovenly drunkards out there have some of the poorest nations. This is a consequence of your worldview, of your actions. Time and again, we have those people who have different excuses and always want to blame the people who are hardworking. But let's go on. The Apostle Paul says in 2 Thessalonians 3 verse 10, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. Now this isn't if a person cannot work. He could be handicapped, could be crippled, might be too young or too old. But if anyone will not work, he should not eat. This means it's better to give people some work and food than just to give them a free handout. That's gleaning. Moral poverty often dooms people to ongoing material poverty. Selfishness, greed, laziness, immorality, short-sightedness, gambling, alcohol abuse, addiction to pornography, indulging in prostitution, drug abuse, all of these sins are symptoms of rebellion against the law of God. And all of these evils inevitably lead to poverty. People are often short of money, are short of money for these reasons. They've shoved their money into vice. It's amazing how many poor people we've had. Oh, give me a Bible. He's got his cell phone, his Coca-Cola, and his Kentucky Fried Chicken with him. All of which cost more than the Bible. But he can't get this subsidized Bible at the Bible Study free. I've got to give him a free Bible. How much money will he put into his cell phone? How much money will he put into his Coca-Cola and Kentucky Fried Chicken? How much money will he put into his chips? But no, he doesn't have money for a Bible. They're not just lazy, they're liars. Victims of self-imposed poverty need the gospel of Christ. And they need discipleship to free them from their lifestyle of self. You can give every single person in a squatter camp R1 million. It'll be gone within the year. And they'll be back in the same poverty. It's proven. They did this case study in Britain. Britain's got the lottery. At the end of, they had 15 different families or individuals that had won over £1 million. £1 million. That's like 10, 11 million rand. BBC did a study on how these people were several years after they'd won the £1 million. With only one exception, every one of them was worse off than they were when they won it. Every one but one. One of them was still roughly at the same level he'd been before, but all the others, where they might have owned their home, now they were renting. They had not, all of them reported that they'd had a massive influx of friends and relatives who leached off them. And that, in fact, all of them said they wished they'd never won the lottery. Even the one who was roughly at the same stage as before, they said it had brought them more grief. The Bible says gaining wealth little by hard work is a blessing. But you know, easy come, easy go. And the trouble is, people, if you gave a poor person R1 million, he'd be worse off in a year's time. It's proven. Why? Because there's a lifestyle change that has to happen if the people are to benefit from such. Victims of self-imposed poverty need the gospel. Now, that's self-imposed. But let's talk about imposed poverty. There are people who are not to blame at all. There are those who are victims of oppression and those who are victims of religious error, and they are the ones that we should be thinking about more. Angola, 1975, was invaded by the Cubans. Fidel Castro's thugs marched in and they took it over as a colony for the Soviet Union, and they destroyed 500 years of Portuguese civilization, wrecked, burned, bombed, massacred from one side to the other. They fed men, women, and children through buzzsaws of chainsaws in the... It was just hideous. Agostinho Neto said he's destroyed the Bible within 10 years. He left to go to a museum and see what a Bible looks like. I've destroyed the Bible, he said. He said that he'd make Angola the fountainhead of the revolution throughout Africa. They nationalized all 600 industries and businesses in the country. They even made diamond mining a losing concern. Since the communists nationalized diamond mining in Angola in 1975, the diamond mines in Angola have made a loss every year. Only communism can make diamond mining a losing concern. They nationalized the buses. They nationalized the trains. They nationalized the banks. Can you read Banco Nacional de Angola? You could say they broke the Bank of Angola. In Huambo, a city of 1 million people, the second largest city in Angola, the people are walking in the city with buckets of water in their head. Why? Well, you can't expect the plumbing to work anymore. There's no electricity, there's no plumbing. So you've got to walk and fetch the water. I've had to go up and down. I remember in Beira being on the top floor of a high building, which you walked up, of course. And I was fed curry by these people. And I ended up running down. There was no water in there. I had to run down and find a pump of water, which wasn't working, and find a river to put out the fire. In Angola, there were more landmines than people. And you could literally... This, by the way, is the National Road. On the Michelin's map, it was a thick red line. But when we got there, we couldn't see the red line. We couldn't see the road. You had to stand and say, ah, I see. Trees this up. This must have been the main road. It took imagination to work out where the road was. The so-called developing world wasn't developing at all, except weeds. Bridges gone, now you're down to dugout canoes to transport Bibles across the river. We were down to ox-drawn sleds to drag the Bibles through the soft sand. 21st century, dragging Bibles and lugging it on your heads like Days of David Livingstone. Angola had more landmines than people. They had no medicines anymore. This clinic was closed for a couple of years because there was no medicines. We took in a few antibiotics, a couple of bottles of antiseptics and antimalarial medicines, and they cheerfully, officially reopened the clinic. It was pitiful. Rewashing the gloves. This is the dispensary. Most of those boxes are empty too. This is Njumba, the headquarters for Free Angola. So we took in medicines to help the medical students being trained. Yeah, they got a skeleton staff as well. And they were back in business because of one mission, bringing in a truckload of medicines. Look how many people had lost limbs due to landmines and air attacks. Now, these are not victims of self-imposed poverty. They're victims of oppression, imposed poverty. It's not their fault. Someone else has come and taken away their leg, injured them, taken away their food, bombed everything. And so these people are legitimate recipients of aid. They are, here's an offering in the church. And all the people could bring for the offering was some grain. That's all they had. And not much of that. What's missing in this church? The building. Yeah, the building's been destroyed. Cubans destroyed the building. But it's not stopping the people from gathering for worship. You see, there are people who will have everything and they're full of complaints and excuses. And there's others who've got nothing, but isn't stopping them from gathering and worshiping. These people are the deserving poor. And so, these are the oppressors, the presidents for life, the emperors, the dictators who have imposed poverty on their people. Central African Republic was declared the Central African Empire. The coronation ceremony of this Emperor Bokassa cost more than the net worth of the country. Mobutu Sese Seko was a kleptocrat of high order. He managed to steal more than a country was worth. Congo, which should have been a rich country, the agricultural potential of the Congo is great. You could provide electricity in the Congo for everybody in all of Africa, just from the one Congo River, from hydroelectricity alone. You could feed everyone in Africa from the Congo alone, from the agricultural potential. Congo's got everything you need in terms of minerals, resources, agricultural potential, hydroelectric power, and yet it was the fifth poorest country in the world, while Mobutu Sese Seko was the sixth richest man in the world. He's interviewed, and he's being asked, how is it possible that your country is the fifth poorest country in the world, but you're the sixth richest man in the world? He said, no, I'm the fourth richest. Kind of proves our point. For many in Africa, liberation, uhuru, and freedom has meant being tied against a tree and shot by a firing squad. In Sudan, we've seen how the government has done scorched earth, burning, bombing, and this has been well documented by Jeremiah Films in Terrorism, Persecution, and Sudan, the Hidden Holocaust. We've documented this in Slavery, Terrorism, and Islam. Oppression consists in governments or individuals violating others' God-given rights to life, property, and liberty. And this takes the form of fraud, theft, violence, inflation. Inflation's a hidden tax, like in Zimbabwe, when they confiscate everyone's earnings and productivity by inflation, by printing more money than there is any value to back it. Socialism is theft. Excessive taxation is theft. Corruption, wastage, inefficiency, all of this is theft. One of the biggest thieves in Africa today, Robert Mugabe and his ZANU-PF thugs. This is Rhodesia. Notice the price of biscuits, 28 cents. This is Zimbabwe today, food queues and empty shelves. Religious error also causes poverty. Unbiblical worldviews underlie the poverty of the third world. The fatalism and the reincarnation beliefs of Hinduism and Buddhism, where the material world is not perceived as real, and where difficulties are understood to be the results of deeds of a previous life. My karma is bad. This is paralyzing to progress. The animist worldview, which sees man at the mercy of outside forces, and the spirits lead people to be shackled by superstitions and fear. And then the fatalism of Islam is also not conducive to productive planning and innovation. And we could add a lot more about the different worldviews, how they put the people into poverty and backwardness. The poor by calamity, the victims of floods and earthquakes and wars, they're the most appropriate recipients of charity. But the aim is always to help them become self-supporting, get them back on their feet again. The poor by exploitation need direct charity to meet their immediate needs, and they need justice in a form of restitution from those who have exploited them and freedom from false religions. Africa doesn't need food. Africa needs freedom. And if Africa got real freedom and the faith of Christianity free throughout the continent, they wouldn't need aid from anyone. We could be sending aid out to other nations. Africa is the richest continent in the world, potentially, in terms of agricultural potential, in terms of minerals, in terms of wildlife, in terms of everything. We've got 20% of the world's land surface, 10% of the world's population. We don't even have 2% of the world's productivity. This, just to remind you what real poverty is, this is the Nuba Mountains. The people come down the mountain, they walk 3 hours to get the water to carry up the mountains on their heads for every drop of water needed for cooking, washing, or cleaning. If you've got running water, praise God. Well, we could say a lot more about it, but I want to give some time for questions. The question is not so much how do people get poor. Poverty is natural. You can be poor with your eyes closed without doing a thing. The question is how does anyone get rich? How does anyone get productive? That's the question. Poverty is a consequence of the fall. Famines were commonplace before the Industrial Revolution. England used to have famines an average of 7 times a century before the Agricultural Revolution. A third of the population died in Bengal in India just in a one-year famine. A third of the total population. There were many famines throughout the... There were so many famines in one famine. In India, 9 million people died of starvation. In North China, 9.5 million people died in a single famine from 1877 to 1878. Only the Christian work ethic and the Industrial Revolution brought the West out of the recurring horrors of famine. a wooden plow drawn by oxen can provide food for one large family. By the 18th century, the new iron plow, which could go deeper, not just take topsoil, and drawn by a horse, could provide food for three families. So now you could have one family farming and two families in the city doing something else. By the 1940s, a tractor pulling a plow could feed 14 families. Now you could have one family rural, 13 families urban, specializing in something else. But now with advanced tractors, tools, and techniques, one farmer can produce enough food for 60 families. This is the agricultural revolution. And this is the solution to famine. You've got to go beyond subsistence farming. Most of Africa's only got subsistence farming. Subsistence farming only works as long as there's no drought and as long as there's no Arabs coming to burn your crops or something like that. That can, you know, one harvest wrecked and that's it. You've got nothing to fall back on. Subsistence farming is not enough. The West's moved into a situation where we can have one farmer feeding 60 families. In that situation, you don't get famine. Then you've got enough to export and to help others. It's an observable fact that the most efficient economies in the world are based on private ownership of property, honest money, free enterprise, and a Christian work ethic. Well, we could ask, is colonialism responsible for poverty? That's just Vladimir Lenin's theory. Garbage. Contrary to the ahistoric mumblings of the coloniophobics, some of the most poverty-stricken and backward nations imaginable never were colonies. Think Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Nepal, Tibet, Liberia. They never fell under Western colonial control. Some colonies like Hong Kong became spectacularly prosperous. Hong Kong at one time had a bigger economy than the whole of China. Some of the richest, most advanced Western nations never had any colonies. Switzerland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Finland, they never had colonies. What made them so rich? Other advanced countries like America, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, South Africa were themselves colonies. Actually, contact with the West has always brought far more benefits than disadvantages. Tea and rubber trees were foreign to Asia, so was millimeal in Africa, and all coffee in the world comes from Ethiopia. The coffee trees aren't indigenous to Brazil. They started in Ethiopia, Abyssinia, they went to the rest of the world. Some of the main scars of colonialism are roads, railways, schools, hospitals, the wheel, written language, the Bible, churches. So instead of blaming colonialism, what about the ancestor-worshipping and idolatrous religions which have rendered whole civilizations powerless in the force of nature? I've been in Zambia during a famine. And there was a village, and the people were starving, and the crops were failing, and it was a bad famine. But within 500 meters of their village was one of the biggest rivers in the world, the Zambezi, flowing. We said, why don't you have some irrigation ditches? The government's got to build that. It's your crops, your village, and your children that are starving. Why don't you build? No, we can't build it. Irrigation ditches must be built by the government. Well, why don't you just get buckets of water and carry them the 500 meters at sunset? So you've got all night for the water to seep in, no evaporation. No, the government must do that. You know, this is what ancestor worship and animism does. You're a powerless, helpless victim in the face of nature. The Christian message frees people from the shackles of tribal thinking and leads them to personal responsibility. Local cultures obstruct material progress by wrong mental attitudes. They see themselves as suffering history rather than making history. Tribalistic philosophies inhibit productivity, they penalize accomplishment, they confiscate what little is produced, and it's the envy barrier. Well, there's a lot you could say on that. Let me just pass by that. Is socialism biblical? Despite exhaustive and imaginative efforts by so-called Christian socialists to promote socialism as true Christian love and sharing, the Ten Commandments still stand. You shall not steal and you shall not covet your neighbor's goods. I mean, even a baboon can see that. Socialism is legalized theft. It's institutionalized envy. By the way, have you noticed how Jimmy around here is a socialist? He believes what's yours is mine and what's mine is mine also. And he believes in a redistribution of hamburgers. Yeah, well, those who didn't see, Jimmy is the baboon who leaps on John's table and grabs his hamburger. socialism has legalized theft. We need to introduce Jimmy to these principles. You shall not steal. You shall not covet someone else's hamburgers. It's the use of envy and guilt that manipulates productive Christians into committing economic suicide. So, let me leave that. You've got a lot more in your notes. But rather than wealth causing poverty, it's far more true to say that what caused poverty is the widespread belief that wealth does. If you have needs, the Bible commands you to pray, to work, to trust God, to be content. This is biblical. The only thing socialism has ever been able to provide its adherents with is the guaranteed income of Romans 6:23. The wage of sin is death.